Thank you very much, Marianne, for that extensive introduction to who I am as a person. I'm not sure what more I have to say. But needless to say, it is with great pleasure that I stand here and deliver my inaugural address. And I thank you very much, Marianne, for that very flattering introduction. I'm also honored, Marianne, that I'm able to deliver this lecture prior to your retirement from the deanship, and also in the 100th year of this faculty. Vice-Chancellor, Dean, colleagues, friends, and family. I arrived from Johannesburg at UCT in January 2011. And this was the first time that I had started a new job in 13 years. So naturally, I was a little apprehensive and slightly awed with the job at hand, given immunology at UCT a new face and building on the excellent work that had already taken place in the division and is still being taken place. But also extending this and introducing some structure and rationale and strategy. And I have been blessed over many years at being able to work with some of the best brains and talented students that have helped me build a solid repertoire of immunology research into HIV and AIDS, some of which I'm going to share with you in this lecture. My talk will be divided into four parts. Well, I will tell you about my own voyage, and then as well to deconstruct the title of this lecture. But before I go any further, what I would like to do is to show you an image of Chimera, where Chimera is a mythological creature with a serpent's tail, a lion's head, and a goat's body. You might think that this would not, this kind of creature doesn't exist in real life, but here is a Chimera cat, and here are chimeric mice with mum and dad and the chimeric offspring. I'm not going to say any more at this stage about chimerism or chimeric creatures, because in my view, and I shall espouse this later on, that this is crucial in terms of who we are and self-preservation. Let's go back. Mary did introduce a little bit about my childhood and blood pies and so on. I want to go back immunologically. At the age of 7, I first really became aware of the immune system when my mother informed me that I had little armed soldiers inside me and were protecting me from the flu. And that sometimes these soldiers, which of course we know are antibodies, feel hungry and have a break, and that's when you feel sick. So this was how she understood the immune system and was really my first immunology lesson. My next awakening was a few years later, at the age of 11, when I was completely captivated by Ruckel Wilksch in the 1966 film Fantastic Voyage. I might have to say I did not see this film in 1966. I saw it quite a few years later. And I was completely spellbound and totally enthralled by the notion that a spaceship-type submarine could be miniaturized with four crew members and then injected into the body of a shot diplomat. So I'm going to show you three clips from this film, because it was really my own genesis of this film. And you will see a submarine being injected into the body, the entrance of the vessel into the lymphatic circulation, and finally the gripping excitement of these white sticky objects sticking to Ruckel Wilksch and a piercing scream of pain.
I always had an idea there was only one system, the circulatory.
The lymphatic system drains off excess fluid from the tissue. Without it, it'll blow up like balloons.
This film was made 47 years ago. In fact, it was probably made longer because it took 2 years to make. Before the first moon landing and before the first heart transplant here in Cape Town. But it also took place the same year that a person called Bill Thompson received his kidney transplant at the age of 15, and I believe he's still alive today. He's the oldest living transplantee. This then does provide a clue that this film had to have borrowed some of the immunological ideas at that time, which were mostly around the antibodies. In fact, if you scan the literature of that time, they were all about antibodies and abuse prevention. So this really got people talking. And after leaving school, I then studied at the University of the Western England and took a major in immunology. So 10 years later, I continued the story of translating my pre-adolescent understanding of immunity to a more academic understanding. And I remember being completely and continuously enthralled at my very first lecture, where I learned that the immune system recognizes foreign invading material by creating an internal mirror image of the invading organism through networks of antibodies, each recognizing each other, and by so doing, resembling the original pathogen. This was a particularly fashionable theory at the time, and around 1981, first proposed by Niels Jerner in the 1970s. In fact, he got the Nobel Prize for it. And there were others that then added on to this in terms of molecular complementarity theories and making up this nice, pretty, quilt-like image. However, these theories did not last the test of time because they were impossible to test for. They were impossible to prove. And if you don't understand this, that's fine. You're not alone because no one else does either. I also recall very vividly giving a treatise of my next eye-opening lecture over a series of years to my then girlfriend, that the immune system can recognize foreign because it can recognize self. This non-self or self-non-self theory was proposed by McFarlane Burnett in the 1950s and really has dominated our thinking ever since. I found this theory of immune recognition intellectually appealing, and that such a molecule known as the MHC, and here is the MHC molecule, could play a central role that also the immune system appeared to be thinking about what it could see and what it could not see. This was very appealing to me. Needless to say, that relationship with my girlfriend did not last. So as Marion said, in fact, it was on the 27th of October, 1984, I arrived in Johannesburg after completing my degree with a strong immunology emphasis. And little did I know then that I would stay in that city for the next 26 years. It was thus no surprise that what seemed perfectly correct and logical for me start my first paying job in the Transplantation Research Unit at Leeds, under the tutelage of Chris Smith and Bert Meidler. Unfortunately, Bert Meidler has died, but Chris Smith is very, I'm very happy that Chris and Jenny were here tonight. And I stayed in that unit for 9 years. I completed my MSc and my PhD in the field of trying to understand immunological targets using the baboon model as our tool and our model to do that. And here we were attempting to induce tolerance to solid kidney transplants from one outbreak animal to another, mimicking the human scenario. And we were attempting to induce tolerance to the transplantation kidney by infusing donor bone marrow stem cells to immunocompromised recipients. My own research revolved around the study of the innate immune system in the baboon and how that played a central role in the induction of tolerance. I remember going to England to the Nuffield Department of Surgery during that time and being addicted to Peter Medawar and books and the immunological philosopher, if you like. And one of the books that I read, which I would like to advocate to anyone in this room to read, which was Advice to a Young Scientist. And after I read that, he proffered a piece of advice which I want to share with you. After graduate students have taken their PhD, they must on no account whatsoever continue with the PhD. So with that, I stopped transplantation research and I moved into HIV immunology. This initially set me on a course of working at the then NIV, as Marion said, the National Institute for Virology, and to study and to look at the lymphoid tissue and how the combination of HIV and TB, this was in 1994, could destroy a person's lymphoid structures. In 1995, I was then awarded the James Gear Fellowship to take up a postdoctoral fellowship at Stanford University, where there I really began earnestly looking at the dynamic interaction of T cells with HIV. So that represents some of my formative years and what led me to immunology and to HIV, and I guess in some ways what has landed me standing in front of me now. So the study of HIV is really an ecology of interactions, ranging from the basic science through to the social, through to the political. But today my focus will be on the science and the ecology of the moving targets when we study the immune system. So if we look at David's circulation, and this is what you might find in any textbook. Oops, there we go. If you look at any textbook, here you see the circulatory system of a generic human being, which I've called David. And there are many organs within this body which are lymphoid organs, and what connects them are the circulatory system. If we then blow up a part of that the lymphatic vessel, and you've heard about the lymphatic vessel in the Fantastic Voyage, you find that through the vessel are the raging torrents of cells that are hurtling through those vessels. If you then pick up two of those cells, I'm going to stop using this. If you then look at two of those cells, you find that the red or the orange and the green are the T cells. They like to bind to each other and they like to touch each other, because perhaps we as humans like to touch it. And one of those cells, the CD8 cells, which I have made a part of my own immunological history, this cell interacts with the target cell. I'll try to go this way. Target cell here, and punches a hole in the target cell. And this cell then disintegrates. And it's by way of which we think that these cells are indeed the protective arms against especially viral infections, and specifically HIV. So going back to the circulation, I put a full portion here because that is to remind me that indeed this is what it's like. But the next image is actually going to be an image. It's not meaning to depict anyone in particular. And for younger viewers, you may want to cover your eyes. But it's really honing the point that the immune cells are particularly everywhere in the human body. So here you see a depiction of the capillaries, the lymphatic system, that's every single part and nook and cranny of the human being. So that indicates that the immune system really is the central part of all health and disease, and that's really what I want to try and get across as well today. So I'm now going to focus on HIV and the immune system. Now, I'm married to a linguist, and so that enables me to, if you like, have a passing notion that some of the words that we use to describe this interaction between HIV and the immune system, it can be seen to be a battle or a war, a hide-and-seek, hijacking, outwitting, tricky, devious, often added to how the virus might behave. But the virus doesn't behave by itself. It behaves in response to something, and that response is partly the immune system. So, as was said in the introduction, I teamed up with my colleagues, Carolyn Williamson, Lynn Morris, and Sylvan Curran, and we set about studying what is happening at that very early stage of acute HIV infection. Because if we know the events that happen at the acute stage of infection, we might know what is going to happen later on in infection. So if we look at a person who might be infected with HIV, what you have is a peak of viremia that comes down to various levels. And in fact, the various levels we call set points. And this depends and is determined by who you are as an individual. And what we think is that T cell immunity is providing some level of pressure that enables or determines, I should say, the level at which this virus is replicating in the infected individual. So we set about measuring some of the very early events during this acute stage of infection. And the higher this set point, the more the rapid course of disease. So what we first went and did, and this was a PhD student, Mantra Malhotra, is he looked at the time course of CD8-positive T-cell reactivity to HIV, specific regions of HIV that we could measure in the laboratory. And we found that there were three patterns. The first was that a single peak of response, which then dissipated very, very rapidly, was met with the changes in the virus. This represents the sequence of the protein that the CD8 T cell recognizes. And so we can get down to the very fine specific nature. And with Caroline's group, we found out that over weeks, 5, 6, 11, and 22 weeks, these amino acid sequences changed over time. And they became fixed from an S to an N at 6, 11, and 22 weeks. And this seemed to always associate with the initial peak in T cell recognition and then what we term as viral escape. So the virus is the target by the CD8 cell, but the virus then moves, and that recognition pattern is no longer there, and therefore the CD8 T cell disappears. The second pattern that we found was an increase in T cell reactivity. Here, we found there was no response at the initial acute stage of infection, but then as you went and continued to monitor the reactivity, there was an increased response over time. And the increased T cell recognition may be related to changes in the virus. We couldn't quite pin that down. And it could be that the virus begins to match the reagents that we use in the assay to measure these T cell responses. The third pattern, and I think the most interesting of pattern, is the sinusoidal waves of T cell reactivity. So this is a physiological phenomenon that is probably occurring, but at the same time, you have this persistence of responses which wax and wane. You have this sinusoidal pattern of reactivity. And this was never related to any kind of selection pressure or viral changes. So the target was not moving, but yet the immune system appeared to be moving in a sinusoidal fashion. And so we found and we concluded that the fluctuating dominance of the T cell recognition is not associated with viral change, and likely means these cells can be detected over time, albeit waxing and waning. So what does all this mean? And this was a great lesson for me over the time and this particular study to try and relate meaning to any of the kind of immunological changes that we find. And the meaning is in the clinical changes, the clinical phenotype of the individual. So here we have the three. We have the lost responses, the new responses, and the sinusoidal persistent responses. In individuals who were progressing slowly, so they had no viral set. They were controlling virus, and they were not progressing to end disease. These individuals had a concentration of these sinusoidal persistent responses. If we look at those individuals that were neither rapidly progressing, nor were they controlling, and we termed these as intermediate progressors, we found that there was an increase in the lost responses. That's kind of tautological. There was a greater proportion of responses that appeared to be lost. And then if we looked at the rapid disease progression, those individuals that had very high set points and were progressing very rapidly in disease and often mostly were then eventually put onto antiretroviral treatment, we found that there was a preponderance, a statistical increase in those that were responding to new. And there were also those CD8 cells that were being lost, and they were mutually exclusive. So we concluded that the fluidity of immune recognition and the higher rates of HIV variation are bad for the host, leading to rapid disease progression. So this is some of the technical, I don't expect you to understand this, and I just want to put the language that we immunologists tend to want to digest. Well, we have these, this is our language, and we say, oh, these are the epitopes that change. And in fact, these are 16 such epitopes or regions that are pretty fine recognized by these cells that are under immune selection. They change. So the question we wanted to ask was, what property of the CD8 cell leads to the changes that we identify in all these recognition patterns? So Catherine Roux, who joined from Canada, she's originally from France, she joined my lab 5 years ago, she went out and looked at the functional property of the CD8 cells. She did this by using very fancy flow cytometry equipment that have 4 lasers that can shine lights in different directions and really interrogate the inside of the cell as well as the surface of the cell. And she looked at the ability of the cells to degranulate or to release components that we know punches holes in the target cell. Also, interferon gamma, which is a cytokine which has antiviral properties and is so predominant in these cells that they are seemingly protected. Macrophage inhibitory protein alpha, which is involved in the migration of cells, the movement of cells along the blood vessels, that I showed you earlier, and tumor necrosis factor alpha. When she looked at these and equated that with the estimated time of these mutations, which we call escape, what really appeared was that the total magnitude, when you add up all these functions, was the only thing that appeared to associate with whether one of these fine epitopes or these fine amino acid sequences changed early or late. The stronger the response, the earlier the target moved. The weaker the response, the later the target moved. So we also wanted to identify and interrogate the permutations of these functions. So I'm going to show you a series of pie charts below here, which haven't appeared yet. Red means that it's a full house. It's a full house of all the 4 different functions. The orange represents any permutation of those 3. The green, any permutation of those, any 2 of those permutations of the 4. And 1, the blue, is any one of those permutations. Now, in the one individual we looked at, we found that the individual who was applying the largest amount of pressure, if you like, on the target of the virus, had a function that was made up of a full house of these measurements that we made. And we call that multifunctionality. A different target that changed much later on was associated with less multifunctionality. So this got us very excited. But when we looked at the rest of the individuals in the series that we actually could identify, we found that there was no difference whatsoever in the functional ability of these cells. And remember, this is all about us trying to hunt down what creates a moving target by looking at the CD8 cell that is creating the impetus for that movement. So the multiple functions of CD8 T cells had no impact on the timing of the epitope mutation. I'm going to come later to find out and to discuss what all this might mean. But then the next question we wanted, what about the CD4 cell? The CD4 cell is the target of HIV. It is the cell that HIV infects. Here is what the CD4 cell looks like. It's a knobbly creature. And the CD4 cells are intrinsic to helping the immune system make the antibodies and also to make the cytotoxic cells. Now, recall that the cytotoxic cells are the ones that punch the holes in the target cell. And the target cells are actually the CD4s. And here is the HIV-infected CD4 covered with the virus or virions on the outer side and injecting the genetic material into that cell. and it completely transforms itself and disables its function. So we wanted to study what happened and happens to that same foreset. So again, Catherine Miller found that there were three patterns. There was a decrease in response, there was either an increase in response. The decrease meaning that when we studied at the very earliest acute infection, there was a peak which declined. That was not found here, and then there was undetected. Now, these are very difficult studies to do because when you try and recruit individuals at the acute stage of infection, you have to make sure that they truly are at the acute stage. We cannot be sure, for example, that this was true at the acute stage when someone has this very high peak of virus. And that's incidentally, that happens with all viral infections, and that is what makes you feel sick. And what we found was that there was a lag in the CD8 cell, which then increased in all types of pattern. And on the right here, you can see that the data have made up these particular cartoon diagrams. But the feature here was that the movement of the CD4s and the CD8 cells, the CD4 cells being the target for the CD8 cells, and the CD4 cells having been infected with HIV, not all of them, but some of them, will therefore also be the target. What she found was that there was a synchronous kinetic. So the first detectable CD4 response in the acute infected individuals that we studied was at 24 days after infection, so 3 weeks. The peak response, which was the maximal response that we could ever identify, was only found 4 days later on average, at 28 days. However, the CD8 response, and remember they do function very, very differently, is that the first detectable response was much, much later at 72 days, and the peak response was appearing at 253 days, almost approaching a year after infection. That's the very peak of response, and this is showing the statistical difference between the time to the maximal HIV-specific targeting of the CD4 or the CD8 cells. So this would mean that the movement of cells, whether they be targets or targeting, are completely different in the infected individual from the acute stage of infection. So the question we also wanted to find and ask was that we know that we have this very peak of response in acute infection of CD4 cells. But what was driving that proliferation? So we used a marker of proliferation, which is a marker that we use in the laboratory to look at nuclear division. And we found that there was a very strong correlation between the viral load in the individual, when we measure the numbers of the copies of the virus, and the ability of the cells to increase in proliferation. However, when we looked beyond the acute stage of infection, at the chronic stage of infection in the same individuals, we found that there was no association. So this peak of response that we find at the acute stage of infection appears to be driven by HIV infections. So the target is the CD4 cell. CD8 cells target the CD4s. The CD4 cells are infected with HIV. And the more at the early stage of infection, that is what drives the proliferation of these cells. So a PhD candidate, Paolo Manetti, who is just finishing his PhD, we wrote a paper a couple of years ago where we looked at the activation of cells and the ability of these cells to proliferate, again, using this marker. Let me went a step further. What we did is that we then isolated the cells that were actively proliferating, this is in the red circles here, and expressing two different activation markers. We also isolated the cells that were not expressing this proliferation and that were not activated. We then took these cells and we then measured the amount of virus inside these cells with fancy PC quantitative PCR methodologies. And we found that in the non-activated cells, there was a certain level of GAG copies, means that that's the number of viral copies inside that cell. But what we found was that there was a significantly increased number of copies in the activated CD4 proliferating cells. So this was the connection we needed to make, that activated CD4 T cells are the drivers of HIV infection. So, to turn to self-preservation. So I've told you about the CD8 cells, and I've told you about the different dynamics of the CD8 and the CD4 cells. And I've told you about the moving targets, whether it's the virus or the CD4 cell itself. So the question is this: how can we go beyond this simple description? How can we extend this, observation? So CD4 cells like to crowd each other. Here are two pictures of cells really huddling around each other. They like to mix with each other and talk with each other by secreting chemicals. Here I'm using this humanized language to generate this point. But however, what binds them together? What really makes these cells come together? So Marian mentioned Immunopedia in the introduction to me, and this is a graphic, a cartoon, and I'm not going to take you through it. Don't worry, you're meant to be very confused by it, simply because it's a wonderful graphic drawn by Shane Locke, who's part of Immunopedia. But what I want to bring you down to is this. I mentioned at the beginning about the self, non-self-self hypothesis that so captivated me at my very early stages. And I guess it still is captivating. Here is the MHC and the T-cell receptor interaction. And here is that little tiny peptide that I showed you all those languages and sequences I developed. I just want to show you this cartoon, because what's happening is that this red sequence is made up of these letters. And we can identify what these letters are. And as I told you earlier, they change. They move. But it is this T-cell receptor interaction with the MHC molecule that is what binds these cells together. And it is what enables the CD8 cell to kill the target cell. It's this binding motion. So this brings me to the role of the MHC. It's the most polymorphic molecule known. It makes us all unique. Whoever you're sitting next to, you are different from the person you're sitting next to, in part because you have a completely unique set of genes. And the most important gene for the immune system is the MHC. So there was a very interesting study looking at the role of the MHC, human migration and disease, pathogen richness. This was a study that looked at all pathogens, whether it be protozoa, helminthic, worms, HIV, TB, malaria, every single different type of pathogen. And what you see here in the red, and the shades of red, are the levels. The darker the red is the more richness of the pathogen diversity. And of course, like any kind of analysis of this kind, it's only as good as the database that can generate this type of data. This was then overlaid with allelic variation. And what does that mean? It means that this is the divergence, or the difference between MHC molecules from each other. And what they found was that there was a positive correlation between pathogen richness and the MHC diversity. So in other words, the more diverse the MHC was, so the bigger the green bars, the more diverse the MHC, the better you had an ability to control pathogen. So MHC genetic variation has co-evolved with pathogen richness, and immune protection to the pathogens is really the main aim of the MHC model. So here we know, and I don't think I need to tell an audience here in South Africa, that in Southern Africa we are plagued with the most terrible burden of HIV infections. And of course, This does enable us to think about this slightly differently. We know that there are people who are able to naturally control virus, but they have a particular MHC background. And this is the human form of the MHC. HLA is just another way of saying MHC, before the language in the mouth. So HLA or MHC, B57.1 and so on, all these are linked to the ability to control the virus and the virus infection. So the question is this really linked to the way that this peptide, in fact, I like to explain how this works to my students when I give lectures, but especially after lunch. Because what I say is, if you run your tongue, and you can all do this now, which is what I say to the students, if you run your tongue over your back molar tooth, and you have a piece of meat or whatever food you have caught, you know it's there. And that is the T-cell receptor. You know that's the piece of food caught in the molar tooth. That's how we can think. So is it really this that is really driving protection? And the more diverse you are, the more able you are to recognize these different types of proteins that are caught in the molar tooth. So are there examples? Of course, I've just shown you examples of those that are elite or long-term controllers. What about others? We know that there are exposed, uninfected individuals who might be at high risk. Sex workers, for example, there are one of the first studies that I did with Slim many years ago was to look at sex workers on the truck stop routes from Peter Maritzburg to Germany. We know that they're highly exposed, but they seem to be HIV negative. Or there's discordant couples where the one partner is HIV positive, the other partner is HIV negative. Or there's infants where we know there's been exposure because the mother is positive, but the infant appears to be negative. What about other natural examples of self-preservation? Well, we also know that when we look at the cousin of HIV, simian immunodeficiency virus, which we know the natural host of SIV is the sooty mangolin or the world monkey, we find these monkeys. Or I shouldn't say we, but others have found that these monkeys have high SIV copies. They have very, very high copies of the virus. There is no CD4 depletion, and there's no immune activation, and there's no disease. If we converse that and look at the picture of Indian macaques, which are often used as animal models to study HIV, but using SIV or hybrid of SIV and HIV should. When these individuals, or these Indian macaques, have high SIV copies, they have CD4 depletion, they have immune activation, and they die of disease. And very much like the human scenario, which is why they're very useful as animal models. So the one we have a natural scenario of no disease, and one where we have the scenario of disease. So the hypothesis is that immune activation or quiescence distinguishes between peaceful and coexistence. Peaceful coexistence and pathology. Pathology being destruction of death. I like to think this is the yin and yang. We're all focused on the yang. The yang is activation. We're all looking like, what is it about activation and how can we stop activation? But I'd like to propose that we look at the yin. The yin is tolerance. If we look at the biological definition of tolerance, it is the ability of an organism to survive or to flourish despite infection with a parasite or an otherwise pathogenic organism. Now, you heard in my own immunological upbringing that I cut my teeth, as it were, in the field of tolerance, trying to understand kidney allograft or kidney transplantation tolerance, certainly in the animal model. And actually, my current position now is that during immunology, half or certainly a good proportion of my time has gone back to that field and trying to understand kidney transplantation tolerance. But what do we mean by tolerance? And I'd like to propose a slightly different way of how we should or could perceive tolerance. We know from the immunology textbooks that tolerance, self, non-self, you have deletion of cells reactive to self, and you have positive selection of cells reactive to self at a certain level. So that the current paradigm, which has dominated the field for 14 years, is that you have deletion of cells that allows there to be tolerance. Let's look at a slightly different way of looking at this. And this is not my theory. It's a theory that has been proposed by Perdue, a French philosopher. He's not an immunologist, but he's working with immunologists, where he proposes that there's a continuity or discontinuity model, and that there is a threshold of immunity. So this is all based on whether the immune system recognizes continuous or predicted motifs or discontinuous motifs. And there's a threshold. Everything below the threshold are patterns which are predicted. They're continuous patterns. And we know that all cells for survival inside the immune system need a level of autoreactivity to keep them there. They react to what we call self. If, however, there is a discontinuous antigenic pattern, or there's a disturbance of that equilibrium or homeostasis, and there's an introduction of some kind of level of discontinuous antigen, there is then an immune response. And if that immune response is effective, it will then clear the pathogen down to a level where there's a continuous and predictable motif that the immune system can recognize and be happy with. However, if there is a persistently discontinuous antigenic pattern, in other words, HIV is a good example where there is a persistent infection, the patterns are always changing. I showed you there was escape, there's a selection push all the time, and the virus is also mutating randomly. It's very stochastic. What then happens is that there is an inability of the immune system to catch up with that change. And so you have a completely discontinuous antigenic pattern, and what happens is that's where you see the incredible activation that we see all the time in infection. So when an antigen is presented in a progressive and continuous way, which is below the threshold, it is tolerant. When an antigen is rapidly ever-changing and persistent, you have an overreactive immunity. So let's turn back to the peaceful coexistence. The sooty mangabeys, who live peacefully with SIV, is their natural host, because there is no overreactive immune response. It's not a question of the virus being ignored. There's probably a very active process of there being no overreaction, because there's a level of tolerance. The macaques who succumb to disease, an overreactive immune response leads to that disease. It's the immune response killing and destroying itself. It's almost, if you like, an autoreactive response. Not autoimmunity, autoreactive. So the peaceful coexistence equals a state of tolerance. And there are many examples of disease in the host caused by this overreaction of immunity to the pathogen, or indeed, sometimes it's not the pathogen. In rheumatic heart disease, where the individual may have been infected many, many years previously with rheumatic fever, many years later, that pattern changes, and you have an overreaction leading to heart disease. You have respiratory syncytial virus causing the destruction of the lungs. It is the immune response to the virus, not the virus, that's causing that pathology. It's the discontinuous patterns. Rheumatoid arthritis, that we know is classically an autoimmune disease, but perhaps we should reframe it as an overreactive immunity to antigens that are discontinuously expressed. Or inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's disease, for example, where you have a level of classically autoimmune disease, but you have this discontinuous pattern. So there are many examples of how we could perhaps potentially reinterpret some of what's going on. So how can we test this? So Marion has alluded to this, and really I've spent the last 22 months having, I think, I would actually advocate to anyone to change. move from one job to another because it gives you the most incredible wealth and depth of time to think about something different. And this is what's happened to me. I've been here at UCT for 22 months, and I've been thinking ever since I've stepped foot here about doing something that is extending the work, some of the work that I've shown you about, but how can we do it differently? And the reason I'm thinking and on those lines is because what I see around me are the most incredible pathogenic diseases that no one is looking at. But also, I want to share with you some of the studies that we've got funded or have submitted for funding. One of which is to look at preterm, i.e. neonatal immunity. We know so little about the infant immune response, and even less about the preterm immune response. I'm not going to go into how we're going to do this, but we're going to come at it from the hypothesis that the infant or the newborn is not immature. The immune system is not immature. And I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that infants are born highly tolerant. They're tolerant of the organisms that they have to encounter. They're tolerant of the maternal antigens that they had to encounter for the previous 9 months. The infant feeding mode, this, and I'll show pictures of all the people that I'm working with. The newborn infant exposed to HIV, this is a fantastic model because we know there's been exposure. We know there's been exposure to the antigen. In the other adult models, we can't really be 100% sure. So people move, they fluctuate. So, and the third is HIV arthropathy, where we are looking within in adolescents, individuals who appear and come to the clinic having swollen knee joints, and it looks like an arthritic joint, and often there's a debate whether this is an autoimmune condition or an inflammatory condition. Well, I would argue that it's an inflammatory condition that's tilting the balance away from tolerance to immune reactivity. So in the 22 months that I've been here, I've been very fortunate and blessed to be able to begin to partner with individuals who are able and have shared beliefs or a shared vision for a model to show that whether this evidence can be accumulated or not. So is Professor Brian Ely, Max Kroon, sorry Max, I know this is a terrible picture, but it is the one you gave. And this is Madeleine Bundes from the University of Amsterdam. We have a new study at the NRC, Mr. President, that could be funded, or could not be funded, but hopefully might be, it's done somewhere, of looking at preterm to actually look and to see whether these infants who are exposed to HIV in the womb and mothers who have preterm births, baby girls, what's is a loss of tolerance. Immune reactivity, Heather Jaskin, who joined my division a year ago along with Jonathan Blackburn, we have a very large funded study to look at the influence of feeding and the influence of breastfeeding on different types of immune antigens, and whether this actually results in immune reactivity and potentially a loss of tolerance. And this is Chris Scott, Kate Brinkley, where we are looking. This is a newly funded, very small amount of funding, but to get going, of looking at HIV arthropathy. So what are the questions? The questions are, does in utero exposure of non-maternal antigens cause disruption of the T cells in the newborn? And does the antigen exposure in the newborn disrupt tolerance, and does HIV accelerate this process? So I would like to think, in terms of self-preservation, there's a balance between tolerance and inflammation. We know that there are particular regulatory-type T cells that promote tolerance, and we know that there are particular inflammatory-like T cells that promote inflammation. And the hypothesis, based on not only some of my previous work and also others around me, is that HIV tilts this balance towards inflammation and precipitates pathology. So HIV vaccines. So I haven't dwelt at all on HIV vaccines, But that's because I'm not really doing vaccine work, I'm doing analog vaccine. But vaccines, we know, provide protective immunity. There's a great richness of public health data to show that across the globe. However, what is the question? What is protective immunity for HIV? Is our approach only tilting the balance of creating an immune response with a vaccine to activation, and is creating this balance towards susceptibility and increasing the risk? I showed you that the activated CD4 cells, and we showed that directly, with those that are preferentially infected by HIV, albeit in the HIV-infected individual, but in the vaccinee, would that also be the case? We are self-preservation is the maintenance of tolerance. Should vaccines therefore be inducing a tolerogenic status? Is it heretic to say that? Is it counterintuitive to say that? In the field of cancer, negative vaccination is a current quest in order to induce a state of tolerance to the tumor, because the pathology is partly the immune response to the tumor. So I want to turn back to the chimera, the Greek mythological entity of the lion's head, the goat's body, and the serpent tail. We are all chimeras of some kind. One of the theories of why the infant is born tolerant could be that during birth or at birth, that infant then becomes exposed to a plethora of organisms from the mother, either through the delivery process or via breastfeeding. And this are the, what we call the commensal organisms, these bacteria and virions that so colonize us as human beings. But we are all tolerant. Hence, the infant is born tolerant to enable that seeding, if you like, to take place. So those organisms become part of us and are still part of us. And anything that disturbs that balance, and HIV could well be one of them, is what leads to that loss of tolerance and promotion of infection. So as the new chair and head of immunology at UCT, it is my job to provide a structure and a rationale and a vision to the division. It is also incumbent upon me to provide a rationale and a structure to the services that we supply through the NHS, because I have a joint position. But the challenge, the overarching challenge of immunology is that it's an ever-moving field. But it is the totem pole of knowledge with which all clinical, pathology, and biological disciplines revolve. And I hope that you walk out of here at least with that message, that whatever we look at biologically revolves around that totem pole. So there are many things. The first correspondence I had was with Greg Lessing when I wanted to apply for the position here. And he called me in my office at the NICD and said, "So you want to do education? Why would you want to do that?" The second person that you're going to hear next is Annalise Williams. The third is the person I had contact with is Val Misradi. I went to see her at Dinchy Hollow Hall in Bronfontein. I knew that she had become director, although it wasn't public knowledge then. Early 2010. And I asked her, "What do you think?" And she said, "Come and join the critical mass and let's blow them out of the water." So with a neutral gumption, that blew it for me. To Sagi Pillar, who's the CEO of the NHLS, and I'm not sure Sagi will hear, but certainly he really helped the move from the NICD down to UCT along with Greg Burgos. I also want to really thank Slim and Karisha and Corinne, because it really was my very first interaction with Slim and Karisha at breakfast in your Pretoria home, 17 years ago, whatever it was, where I explained about the role of the MHC. And somehow, the MHC had some role to play with HIV infection, but we didn't know. And I think that spurred our collaboration since that time. And also just to say that I think the cohorts that you established, dear Professor, have really been an incredible insight and benefit to all of us here at UCT. To Carolyn and to Lynn, my longtime collaborators in the field of research, to Wendy, who ever bubbling enthusiasm has created a great momentum of certainly moving on the immunology within the Professor cohort. To Linda Gehr and Robin. Robin, actually, I don't know if Robin's here, but I called Robin almost 20 years ago because he went to Stanford and had the same mentor that I had at Stanford, Thomas Merriman. And I wanted to know what he thought of Stanford and what he thought of Thomas Merriman. And he told me it's a dog-eat-dog society. If you can survive that dog-eat-dog, you can live and survive anywhere. And he's right. to Joanne, the generosity of the corporates who grants together and were funded to at the Yang, the activation site, not the Ying. And to Hoyan, who I share with Joanne, and to all the other people here at UCT, and I'm sure there are many others who I haven't mentioned. And then to my family lastly. Before we had children, we uprooted ourselves and went to California for 3 years. We sold the house, we sold the cars, we did everything. In fact, we didn't. We got the in-laws to the garden. But we uprooted ourselves. But to come from Johannesburg to Cape Town now with two young girls is no mean ask, but they did it. And I'm happy to say that my two girls are at schools and they're loving it. And Heather is now here at UCT. I don't know if your colleagues are here, have a welcome. And we are happy here at Cape Town and happy here at UCT. Thank you very much.